This is Icon Art Radio. Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, Bill Teeple. That's me. Okay, Donna, you had a thought you mentioned to me. Let's see where we go with it.
Yeah, it was just a sentence I read somewhere. I don't even remember where I read it, but I liked it. The person in this book or article said, "You have some of the genius and magic of everyone." And immediately what I thought of when I read that sentence was things like how I feel when I'm watching a film of Merce Cunningham dance, for example, or Olga Corbett doing gymnastics. It makes me feel like I'm doing that myself. You know, I could never do those things with my actual body, but it somehow makes me feel all of those movements in my actual body, such that afterwards when I get up and walk across the room, I'm moving differently. I feel different. I feel a little bit of Merce or Olga within me. Same thing with that movie, The Magic of Picasso, where you actually see him painting and making his brushstrokes. I find that when I go and do art myself afterwards, my arm is actually moving more like his arm. And it isn't because I'm trying to imitate him. It's because something, some little energy of that I have within me resonated with some particular energy that he had to a much greater degree, but the connection was very real. And it can happen with singers or anything, you know, anything that we can't do fully as well as the person that we're admiring, but we have a touch of that in us. And so anyway, I thought that was would be a good.
Well, it sounds like Pragya Bharat to me. It sounds like the ultimate mistake of the dweller in the body, you know. It has a thought and it thinks, oh, I thought that thought. Mm. And this is the externalization of that same tendency to identify, to put the sense of self into whatever is happening.
Yeah, it seemed to me you were describing the way human intelligence moves in existence.
Yeah, yeah, it's really
basic.
Which
is what you're talking about.
Right, right, yeah.
This
yeah.
thing that we're in, because, and it doesn't just happen on the level of an amateur or a non-participant watching a real person doing it. And because I used to watch Rudolf Nureyev leap, and then my body would start to leap, you know?
Right, yeah.
It's the way creative artists all at a similar level create together a new universe tomorrow from today. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have movements. And you have, you know, rock and roll, and then one person tries something out and then another artist, without actually intellectually deciding he's going to do that same thing, picks up on it. It's like we're moving as one intelligence through time.
Zeitgeist.
And,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one person does, and there's this, I don't know if I can remember, there's the thing about intelligence. This is some kind of Vedic thing, like Rishi Devatan Chandas, or no, like, never mind, forget all that. Just intelligence seeing something and then becoming that. And then the intelligence bounces. That looks at a third and becomes that. And this is the way the whole thing progresses. And
which is the process of creation. And I, Bill, have been talking a lot about the source of the creative impulse. And why people throughout all of the centuries and every culture imaginable have wanted to create something, make art. And I think this thing that we're talking about too, when you see something or hear something or just, you know, even have some memory of something and it sparks something else, that's part of that process. We don't want to just have the experience. We don't want to just watch Merce Cunningham dance or look at a Picasso painting. Immediately, when we look at that, we want to do something with whatever experience we've had interacting with that. The process of creation wants to keep on going.
And I see it really with the young people, the kids. The one kid will do something, and then the next kid will have to do the same thing, will want to do the same thing. And they're all just, it's all this bouncing back and forth of creativity around kind of clicking into that. It's like until somebody thought of that idea, mm-hmm. it was latent. Mm-hmm. And then one kid or one artist does something, and then now that thing has become awakened mm-hmm. in us all. And so then you have a whole school of art, you have a whole bunch of kids downstairs all collapsing the cups with the hot water and pouring paint into them, and it's the coolest thing in the world.
And it's not all conformity either. It's not just, you know,
no,
I want to be like the
other. It's neat.
Right. You just, it's an expansive thing. It's very interesting.
It's also the, I think, just a manifestation of the underlying reality that that other person doing that thing is actually me.
Yeah.
Anyway, I am doing that, but I'm not getting the full experience of it unless I physically do it too, mm-hmm. because I'm still limited to my physical awareness.
Yeah.
I used to have a terrible time. I in New York, I would go to the Five Spot two or three times a week to listen to live jazz. And fortunately, it was in the era when, you know, Charlie Mingus was playing there and Miles Davis was playing there, and you'd actually hear these people. But I couldn't just sit at the table and listen to what they were doing. I really needed to play the trumpet. I needed to go up there onto the bandstand and play trumpet with, you know, with these incredible performers. And of course, I couldn't begin to play the trumpet the way I would need to do that. So it was a fascinating sort of bittersweet form of enjoyment.
So what did you do then after you went home from the Five Spot? What did you then? Was there anything that you could do to?
No, there really
fulfill
wasn't.
That impulse?
There really wasn't. It was what happened more and more was that I got caught up in this impossible dream of becoming a great jazz trumpeter, and then it was constantly, you know, transmogrifying into becoming a great jazz pianist or becoming a great, you name it. And it was just whenever I saw some wonderful performer performing, I identified with the performer so intensely that I couldn't think of anything else that would be worth doing other than to somehow emulate that level of skill in that particular field. But once the performance was over, you know, reality would come sneaking back in, and I would realize that in order to play the piano that well, I would have to devote my life to it. And I didn't want to devote my life to it. I just wanted to experience it the way he did. And, you know, plus it would be nice to be able to express yourself in a medium that fluently. But to do that, you really actually have to devote your life to it. And I ended up devoting my life to something else.
But this is exactly what 10-year-olds that end up being great artists do.
Yeah.
They actually make a decision. You see,
right.
If you look at the lives of artists, you'll see that at somewhere around between 9 and 13, mm-hmm. a kid has that experience and decides they're going to go for it.
Yeah, I'm going to be that.
And if they don't, I mean, it's actually hard to become that, that good and that successful and that obsessed and that committed.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually means the kid has to, like, drive it through, too. The parent said, but I always wanted you to be a doctor.
Right.
Well, and there's also another thing, too, at any age that can happen when you have that experience, because the identification is so, the connection, the kind of inner recognition that, you know, that person is really not separate from me. The part of you that resonates with that talent is fully alive in you, it's sometimes really surprising that you can't do it. I remember traveling in certain countries and hearing people speaking the language and literally being baffled momentarily that I couldn't do that because it just seemed so natural. I'm here in this place and I ought to be able to understand and speak French. Why can't I? Or watching Olga Corbett live doing her gymnastics, she was like a child in the backyard and she looked the way I feel inside a lot of times. You know, even though I was 28 years old when I was watching her and couldn't do gymnastics at all, but I watched her moving that way, and it was literally hard for me to understand why I couldn't just get up and do that in, you know, across the room.
Yeah.
Well, I can understand why I can't do gymnastics. But on the other hand, as an artist, I am a trained artist, and I would see, I would want to be able to do something like a certain kind of art style. And it would be difficult. When it's difficult there, then there's a frustration.
Well, I think there also there's, you know, there's this gap between what really is possible and what is going to happen when you try to use your equipment to achieve it. Because, you know, we all could probably do very, you know, successful renderings of any kind of scene that we could see. We've been immersed in our binocular vision for decades, and, you know, there really isn't any terrible mystery about doing a straightforward spatial rendering of something. But then when you actually go to do it, if you haven't been trying in the past, if it's your first shot, the chances are, you know, you won't know how to use the equipment correctly, and you'll be drawing things that, you know, don't look anything like what you look at. Then it becomes a mystery and a path of discovery, finding out how the machinery works and how to get the machinery to do what you want. And then, of course, as we've discussed a million times, at some point, having learned that, it becomes the next layer of discovery of how to get out of the way and let the machinery itself do all of it, and you don't have to actually lift a finger.
So this recalls the last show that we did, where we talked about the blank canvas, and that there's a lot more fun in dreaming and getting ready than there is in actually doing it, because now I've lost my train of thought. Go ahead. Just talk,
I wonder
talk,
why.
Talk, talk. That's why we turn these things off.
Well, the blank canvas, yes, the overshadowing power of all.
Well, no, it's hard. I've got it back. It's just hard work. Figuring out how to make the, you know, work the machinery, the mind-body coordination, everything that's involved, actually being able to render that thing the way you'd like to. That's a lot more work than actually going and hearing Miles Davis play and imagine and wanting to do it.
Well, again, though, you get up there and you start blowing through your trumpet, and, you know, everyone leaves immediately.
And that brings to mind another thing, which is that there's probably a thousand really good professional trumpeters out there, and there's only one Miles Davis. And what is the magic there? Which is what we've discussed.
We did
many
a whole
times
show
before.
On that one time. Well, the other thing I was thinking of in the light of this was when I was doing those cards that I called Snowmen of the Masters, and I was looking at master drawings by Rembrandt and Dürer and Bruegel and all, and doing these drawings of snowmen in those styles, there was something remarkably educational and satisfying just looking at those lines and then taking especially Rembrandt, because you can't do it like carefully, you know, you have to just like be bold and make this fluid line with your brush and some ink. And I felt such a connection with them just to get that, just to kind of like play with that and get that snowman to have that quality of this Rembrandt drawing. I knew I was not Rembrandt, I was not Dürer, I was not Bruegel, but there was some aspect of them that really entered me, that was really awakened in me when I was doing that.
And this brings us back to where this all got started.
Yeah.
I teach my students to go find the best teachers, and those are the masters in the museum, that I can place their attention on certain things, they can practice and practice. But if they go to the museum and look at a masterwork, that you'll start to become him. Mm-hmm. There's this magic that you're talking about that happens. It just starts to get you start to be able to perform that way just by exposing yourself to the real thing.
Sure. Well, that's part of how art works in the first place, is it's that the experience of the work connects you with the experience of the artist, and the extent to which it makes that connection is dependent on, you know, dozens of variables. But ultimately, you know, we're all becoming Van Gogh, we're all becoming Rembrandt a little bit. And you know, if you pay attention to a work, then you have a better shot at having that level of experience, instead of just saying, yeah, that's blue, or it's kind of pretty. But that's, I think people are doing that in their perception of pretty much everything. It goes back to that same mechanism of identification.
And that, I mean, really, we are that one intelligence, and that the Rembrandt-ness in us gets stirred mm-hmm. by standing in front of the Rembrandt. We become that Rembrandt begins to become manifest. That's why if a certain school of art goes away, or is out of sight, or not in fashion, or something, it recedes from the surface of life, and it can be rediscovered at a later time.
And it's a dialogue, you know. I think that's why people like to come to Video Night and Odd Thursday and see the images of other artists. In Video Night, they can actually see the artist working. On Odd Thursday, they can see slides of the works. But there's something about keeping the process alive of having a dialogue with that form of creative energy that keeps our creative process sparked and
right, and that's
lively.
My role here in this town and the region is to nourish. It's like fertilizer, you know, showing the videos, talking about it, looking at the art. It nourishes that in everybody that walks in the door.
It's the Bandini effect.
And yes, Alan, what is the Bandini effect?
Well, that's for those of you who may have lived at one time in Southern California where...
I know, I used to sell Bandini. I used to shovel Bandini.
Yes, it's the most popular brand brand name in fertilizer.
Because I grew up in the nursery business, did you know that?
Yeah, yeah. Bandini.
We sold Bandini fertilizer.
Huh.
There you go. Yeah. Now, I have one more thing to say before we run out of time.
We have 10 minutes.
Oh, boy. let's keep going here. And for those listening, this is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and Bill Peeple. that potential, these potentials we're talking about for anything are in everyone. That's the theme here. And my example of that is when I was an athlete. I was at a certain level. I was a high jumper. I wasn't very tall, but I could really jump pretty good. And I remember the huge advancement I made as a jumper was that I dreamt that I could do it. And by, you know, the summer before I had the big advancement in my jumping in the fall, I had dreams of being able to jump, like fly or float over the bar really high. And when I went to do it again in the fall, I could do it.
See, okay, that's exactly what happened to my daughter, Adrienne. When she was 15, 16 years old, and she could sing on key, but she was very timid about it. And she was always cast in the musicals in town in the chorus because she just didn't have a very powerful voice. We went to New York that summer, and she and I went to see Ragtime. And we were sitting in the first row of the mezzanine, and she was leaning forward on the railing, absolutely locked in to watching this show the whole time. And she came back from that and tried out for a part in Into the Woods that Rodney was producing then. And she had decided which part she wanted, and she'd memorized the song. She wouldn't let any of us in the family listen to her practice this song. And she went and auditioned for this play, and Rodney said he absolutely almost fell on the floor because suddenly she just had gotten it in her body that, oh, that's what you have to do. That's how you have to project. That's how you have to be in your body on the stage. And she just did it. And, you know, this from that point on, her voice was powerful and strong and all of that. But it was a very sudden, just like your dream. It was a really sudden
perfect
thing.
Perfect example of what we're talking about.
So I think all of this is, we've said this on a lot of our shows, we say it all the time in Odd Thursday too, how important it is to keep listening to really good musicians and keep going to art museums, not just look at books, because art books are wonderful. There are magnificent art books out today, but it's not the same as actually looking at Cézanne's brushstrokes or hearing, you know, being in the room and hearing the notes that are coming out of the instruments of some of these people or
yeah, I wish we could all go listen to Miles Davis again.
But yeah.
He's gone. He's playing with Gabriel now.
But like you were saying in that other show about memory, it's mm-hmm. like once, if we have at any point done those things,
yeah,
and then when you hear the reproductions,
exactly.
When you listen to the Miles Davis CD or you see the print in the art book, it brings back what you experienced when you were live.
And the genius that's in these guys, it comes through even in the the prints and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they'll stir you. But to go, if you're making that really deep connection with the soul of the artist, that can really happen the best standing right in front of it. Mm. Or hearing watching him perform. You're really in sync with that. And there's a level of of oneness that's attained in performance or with the artwork, that is this recognition of that we're all, that's it, and that this is it, and that this moment, this experience of beauty, which I'm so obsessed with, this experience of beauty, life being completely lived in present time, it happens in the realm of art, and that's why art is so special to us, that We're really lucky that there is this thing called the art world available to us in culture.
Yeah. It's interesting that we live in an age where reproduction is actually omnipresent. And so we have this new discovery to make that even a really good reproduction of something isn't the same as the original thing. You know, it's like eating the very best canned peas or the absolutely finest frozen peas. It's not even related to the experience of eating fresh peas. And many people have never had, I mean, probably the majority of people nowadays have never had a fresh pea. Mm. And I remember the first time I had some garden peas in Vermont. I'd been living in New York City. I grew up there and I had never had garden fresh peas. And when I had them, it was astonishing. And I ever since then I've thought, boy, it's too bad we don't know how to, you know, preserve things more successfully so that other people could have that experience. And similarly, you know, you can look at the absolute finest reproduction of a Rothko painting and I don't care how good a reproduction it is, it's nothing compared to seeing the actual painting.
And you don't even know why. It's like, again, I think I told this once on the air before, when I took my daughter into the Rothko room in the Tate Gallery in London, she had no idea who Rothko was at all. And she was, you know, she's in her 20s, she walks into the room, and he takes a little glance around, and like, well, what's the big deal? And then within 30 seconds, she had to sit on a bench because they just like overtook her. And she just looked at me and said, Mom, what are these paintings doing to me?
Yeah.
And I looked around and there were several other 20-year-olds, 20-somethings, you know, sitting on the benches, just communicating with those paintings and wondering what is the power of this room? But it was very real.
Yeah. So we're gradually learning that real things are quite different from fake things.
Yeah. I had you were talking about the garden peas. I had the experience last night. Somebody came over for dinner and brought some fresh asparagus that had been just picked yesterday afternoon. And I've had plenty of fresh asparagus, even that I bought at the farmer's market. But I had never tasted asparagus as good as that we had last night. It was amazing. It was very sweet and just something completely different about it because it had only been picked a couple hours earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something about present time, being present, the now, and all of this. And once that sort of gets straight in your head and you're able to live in the moment and experience things fully, then the reproduction stuff has its place and fits in all right. But yeah. If we're lost in images of reproductions of reproductions of reproductions, which seems to be the nature of this age, you can really feel like you're in a virtual no man's land.
Sure. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much of a difference there can be between a reproduction and an original thing, whether it's music or painting or anything else. And I don't think we've ever had a civilization that had to deal with that. I mean, I remember in my youth, there was sort of an awareness of the difference between fake things and real things because the reproductions were new and they were fairly incompetent. And, you know, people in the 60s got fed up with plastic flowers and things like that because they just looked stupid and they were kind of an insult to your intelligence. But as we've gotten better at fabricating things, there are a lot of plastic flowers out there that you can't tell are not real flowers until you get pretty close to them. And I think people now can grow up in a world where they're looking at representations of things and simulations of things, and it might not occur to them for quite some time that there's a significant gap between what they're seeing and what that thing is actually representing.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.